Hospital 6.
So we never knew what we would find in these file folders because they were not organized. And so we had to look at each page separately. And much of what we found was of no particular use, but lots of it obviously was because there were numerous trials and these documents were used. Since all but one of the attorneys spoke no German, and the documents, of course, were in German, those of us who worked there, we were called research analysts, then prepared a short resume of the content of a document that we deemed of value. And that was then sent to Nuremberg to the attorney working on the case. If the attorney found that this was a valuable document, it would then go to the translation section and they would translate it word by word. Once in a while, I was in Nuremberg, but most of the time, I was in Berlin. I'd like to say something about this colonel who ran the document center. He obviously had greater sympathies with the Nazis than with his American allegiance. He knew that we were. Most of us working down there were Jewish. Most of us were former Germans. And he hated us, I think, with a passion. There were only two ways to get to this document center, which was way underground, deep underground. It was an elevator and a staircase. And he had, after we got there, he had the staircase brick shut. So we only had the elevator. And periodically he would cut off the power. And we had no way of getting out or getting in if we were not in. The electric light would go out. We couldn't see. We were set in the dark. And because it was so deep underground, there was also a ventilation system there. And that would be off. And so after a while, we brought candles. But when the power was up for a very long time, we became afraid, what the candles use up oxygen, what's going to happen? So we were very careful about burning only one candle, which meant we really couldn't work. And we informed Nuremberg about this and asked them to do something about it. And were told that since this document center is run by the army, there is nothing that Nuremberg can do about it because Nuremberg is run by the War Department and not by the Army. And so we did the best that we could. There were some instances where we had reason to believe that some documents disappeared, but we couldn't ever prove anything.
What was his name?
I don't remember. I may have something in amongst my Nuremberg material that has his name, but right now I can't think of it.
Can you remember the contents of any of the documents that impressed you? Were there any particularly sort of vivid?
Since I was working on the trial of the doctors who performed medical experiments, it's such cold, unfeeling detail of how the experiment was conducted, what the people on whom the experiments were conducted, how they handled themselves in the course of the experiment, as though we were talking about objects and not human beings. Total detachment. One document in particular, Joe, gave me a big jolt. It was sometime in 1947. There was a list of people who were sent to Auschwitz. It was not the entire list because who knows where the beginning of it was. but I found my father's name on there. And the list was dated February 1942. And I bought it jokingly. At the same time, I realized that I've had a letter from my father as late as August 1942. So that's not possible. Because in February 1942, he was still in France. And he was there until August, so that list doesn't mean anything. Still, denial. Now, I don't know the significance of that list. I'd never made a copy of it. I wished I had, but I didn't. Whether it was maybe planned as early as February, what was going to happen in August, I don't know. And I don't know who issued that list because part of it was missing. So there was the first page was not there. I remember, for instance, being in the Nuremberg, and this was still when the international trial was going on, but I was already working there. During a recess in the trial, I stood in front of Goering. I didn't say anything. I just looked at him. And again, he was obviously uncomfortable. And he didn't know who I was. And I was wearing a uniform. We were given American uniforms. And so he probably didn't even suspect that I would know German. And he said to his German defense counsel, in German, who is this little one? What does she want? And the defense counsel says, I don't know who she is, but she obviously works for the prosecution, and I don't know what she wants, but just don't say anything, don't do anything. And I'm thinking, here is Goering, whom not too long ago I would have feared mortally, and here I am. And he's afraid of me. Who would believe, and again, I always came back to this, and I still do sometimes now, little Hetty from Kindergarten. And there is Goering, and he's afraid of me. There were some strange things that happened in Nuremberg, because, as I said, periodically I was there. And one time when I was there, I was asked to accompany one of the defense counsels while he was interviewing one of the witnesses who was lent by the British, a man by the name of Wolf, I remember. And the British were going to try him later on. And normally, when the defense counsel, the German defense counsel, was accompanied by somebody from the prosecution, which was done on a sporadic basis just to make sure that all is okay, they would always introduce the person by name and saying that this person is from the prosecution. But when at this time, the attorney forgot to say that, apparently, and I didn't say anything. And after we were there for a while, he said, I forgot to bring this document. I need to go back to my office. And his office was in the Palace of Justice in Nuremberg, and where the trials took place. And so I was left alone with this witness, and he was behind bars. And he said to me, you can do me a big favor, and you will be richly rewarded for this. You know that there is censorship, and I have a letter here that has to be mailed, but it cannot go through the regular system here because it will be censored and it has to get out without that. So if you would take that and mail this letter for me, put it in, I had a notepad with me, he said, put it in your notepad and nobody will see it. And when I know that it's been received, you will be rewarded. Give me your name. What is your name? And the defense counsel comes back at that moment and says, I forgot. I am so sorry. This is Hay Rockenheimer from the prosecution. And the man says, I'm so sorry. I apologize. I shouldn't have done this, and please forgive me, give me this letter, and of course I don't want you to mail this letter. And I said, no, I will take care of it. It will go to where it should go. And I gave the letter to the censorship division. I opened, and later on found out that it contained some information on a person that we had been trying to locate and had not been able to find, and it led the way to that person. So, another funny story, or humorous story. Later on, some of the people who were quote-unquote maybe lesser criminals and well-behaved while in jail there were permitted on the weekends to go home to visit with their families. And this one man came back apparently Sunday evening at 6 o'clock and told the guard, who was an American GI, spoke no German, and this man spoke no English, but tried to convey to him that he wants to get back into jail, and his GI is sending him away. And so the man had to spend the night somewhere in Nuremberg and reported the next day that I was here last night, but I couldn't get into jail.
How about the doctors? Did you actually see any while you were there?
Yes, I saw all the doctors who were on trial.
Do you remember their names?
Some of them were not actually doctors, some were administrators, but responsible for the program, I mean, for the experiments, but so they were also on trial. The lead person, if perhaps that's the proper way to describe him, in the trial was Rudolf Pant, who was Hitler's personal physician. I remember sitting in one during the trial of these doctors, one session, and there were three American judges, one of whom most of the time slept, or at least appeared to be sleeping. He had his eyes closed. But he suddenly seemed to wake up, and he must have heard the word concentration camp and asked the witness, who was one of the doctors, what is a concentration camp? And was told it was a recreation center for Jews. Thank you very much. And seemingly went back to sleep, or at least he closed his eyes. Which was, I found rather disturbing. And he didn't question that. What do you mean, a recreation center for Jews? Did he believe it? I don't know. There were some very difficult situations. Reading these documents and the callous descriptions, or being in the courtroom and hearing how callously they talked about it and how detailed, describing how the victims behaved during the experiments, how they died. And I couldn't eat. I would vomit. I couldn't sleep. But I went on with it because I felt it was important. And yet I questioned how much was really done. Some of the people were sentenced to death and were hung. I didn't believe in death, and that the death sentence is an answer. Then I still don't believe in the death sentence being an answer. I don't know what happened to the people who served a certain length of time in jail. Kind of ironic, the people who were executed, who were hung in the prison in Landsberg, which is where Hitler was imprisoned and wrote Mein Kampf. One of the doctors who was on trial, Dr. Rose, I think he received 10 years jail sentence. when he was picked up to be brought to Nuremberg, he was all set to be picked up. His suitcases were packed. He was all dressed and ready, waiting to be picked up. But waiting to be picked up to be brought to the United States where he was going to do some research. And when he found out who these people were that were picking him up and where they were going to take him, he protested and said, you know, this is all a mistake. I'm to go to the United States. But he was brought to Nuremberg. Now, I wonder, did he ever come to the United States and conduct his research? So, you know, I question really a lot of the value of the trial. I mean, the international trial sets some precedents in terms of law, international law, which is applicable to other atrocities that are being carried on in this war. You know, for instance, you know, Saddam Hussein might be tried under that law. I'd like to see that happen someday. I'd like to see that law applied when people in some of the Central American countries who have not been tried, who should be tried, people in El Salvador, in Guatemala, Chile, and so on. I understand that it was known that Göring had the opportunity to commit suicide. That apparently when his wife came to visit him one time, they kissed and she, by mouth, transmitted to him the cyanide pill that he later on took and committed suicide. Now, if that was known, why was that permitted? Why was he permitted to keep that pill? I mean, I knew it. I don't remember how I learned, but I knew that. And why was that allowed to happen? If indeed the man was to be executed, my feelings aside, how I feel about that, why was that permitted? I think there were some documents that were found by one of my co-workers that would have incriminated one of the Dulles brothers. That document disappeared.
These would have been the American Dulleses?
Yes. But apparently he had dealings during the war with Germany through Switzerland. And one of my co-workers found it. And they disappeared.
Would these be the Foster Dulleses? Am I thinking of the right
Alan
people?
And
John.
Right. Mm. And it was one of them. I don't remember which one. I believe it might have been Alan Dulles, but I'm not sure anymore. It was one of the Dulles brothers. So I'm questioning, you know, the sincerity of the whole thing. I'm sure there were people that working there who were very committed, but somewhere in there, and I can't point my finger at anyone, but somewhere there was also something, some other interests that were pursued. And, you know, I'm wondering why so many people, I mean, for instance, are people that were known to be Nazis, like the man who just recently died, the butcher of Lyon, I cannot think of his name, Klaus Barbie. I mean, why was he allowed, it was known who he was, it was known what he was responsible for, why was he allowed to work with the American government, for the American government? So there were some other interests at hand there. I don't know who's responsible. I can't point fingers. I have some notions about it, but I'd rather not say because I don't know. You know. Well, left the working for the American government in March of 1948 because the war was essentially over, and went back to England. However, in the summer of 1947, I was beginning to, I realized that my time will soon be over, and what am I going to be doing then? And I really did not want to go back to England. I just had very bad feelings about England. I blamed England wrongfully, admittedly, for not being with my parents. Although, if it hadn't been that England had accepted me, my fate might have been the same as my parents. But I guess I was so unhappy being separated from my parents that I had to blame somebody, and so why not blame England? And so I really didn't want to go back to England, and I didn't know where to go. And my parents had hoped, I knew, to go to the United States. But the United States I looked at as this over, this terrible country that was a capitalistic country that was doing bad things to its working people. And did I really want to go there? And I thought, but where can I go? Where do I want to be? And I really didn't know where. And so I decided I would come to the United States. And I had two uncles and aunts in the United States, my mother's younger brothers, one of whom, with his wife, had been able to come to the United States in March of 1938. And the other one was probably amongst the last people to leave in early 1940. And they had offered to bring me to the United States, but I said, no. But then by summer of 1947, I was thinking, well, maybe I want to go. And so I approached them, and they gave me an affidavit, and I did come here. Then in May 1948, I came to the United States after returning to England in March of 1948, and immediately registered with the American consulate and tried to also get passage on a boat. And boats were just very much booked up, or there were few, and those that were available were booked up for a year or more. And so I decided, I don't want to stay in England once I get my visa. And I will get it very quickly because the German quarter was wide open, and because the Germans couldn't apply. And so I knew my turn would come very soon, and I would get my visa, and it will expire before I can get on the boat. So I need to find a job in a travel agency and see what I can do to get a passage. And I was willing to do anything, sweep the floor or whatever. And I got a job typing in a travel agency. And to this day, I only type with three fingers. And somehow I got that job. And the man that I was assigned to realized quickly that I didn't well on the typewriter, and so he assigned me to answer the phone. And I still had a valid PX card. Somebody had forgotten to void it, and there was a PX nearby, and I was smoking at the time, so I was smoking American cigarettes, and he was wondering, where do you get American cigarettes? Do you have an American boyfriend? And I said, no, I get them from the PX. PX? Where's the PX? What do you get at the PX? I noticed you're wearing nylons. And in England at that time, I don't think there were any nylons to be had. And he said, I have a girlfriend, and she doesn't have any nylons. And so I said, well, I could take you to get her some nylons from the PX because I get more than I could use. And I can hear it. Why don't you take a pack of my cigarettes or whatever's left of it? And I thought, maybe I can, you know, sort of bribe him or something. And so I began slowly to talk to him about that I'm planning to go to the United States, I'm waiting for a visa, and that I don't have passage. And he said, well, we can put you on the waiting list. And I said, yes, I know, but the waiting list is so long, and I don't want to wait that long. I'm very anxious to go. Now that I've made up my mind, I want to go when I can go. Well, there is just no way that this can be worth it. So I took him to PX a few times, and he let him loose there to buy whatever he wanted for himself and his girlfriend. And then I got my visa. I came home, and I went there on a Tuesday night, and it was in the mail. And on Wednesday, I went to work, and I said to him, I got my visa last night. The Queen of the Rivers is the next boat leaving on Friday in Southampton, and I want to be on it. He said, there is no way. You have to be on the waiting list, and I told you. And, you know, you should be on the waiting list. Now you'd be the last one on the waiting list. Had you gone on it a few weeks ago, you'd be not the last one. And I said, that waiting list is useless to me. I need to be on this. And he said, it's all booked. And the phone rings, and this woman is hysterical, calling up. She came from Wales, and she lost her passport. And she's to be on the Queen Elizabeth's on Friday. And she cannot get another passport. And what is she going to do? And she needs to book passage on the next boat, because she can't get on this one. And so I'm thinking, how can I get this? And I talked to this man again, and he said, well, I would like to have a watch. My girlfriend would like to have a watch. I'd like this, I'd like that. I said, let's go to the PX. We went to the PX, and I had a passage. This woman's ticket. On the Queen Elizabeth on Saturday, on Friday, I was on that boat. And a friend of mine later on, about 2 years later, she was on the Austrian course. He was the one who worked with me in Nuremberg and at the Civil Censorship Division. She got her visa, and it was still difficult to get a passage. And so she asked me if I remembered the name of this man, and I did at that time, I don't know. And I gave it to her, and she went there, and I said, you know, whatever he wants, I will send it to him from here. And he was in jail, and I often wondered, am I at fault? I probably may have contributed, I'd like to probably think I contributed, probably. He's done crooked things all along because it became very easy for him to do this. But I don't think.
How would you rate sort of America compared with England as sort of being receptive to, you know, if I can use the term refugee?
Well, I came to England at a totally different time than I came to the United States. And so I'm comparing different time periods. I mean, I felt when I came in 1939 to England, of course, my contact was so limited. It was the family I lived with, and it was the children in school and the teachers. And I felt very welcomed. And the only time that I experienced a problem in England was in 1948. When I came back from Germany, and I was looking for a job, and I filled out an application, and the man that looked at it said, oh, you're Jewish, we don't hire Jews. And that was my only negative experience in terms of receptivity in England. When I came to the United States, it was a totally different time. And I felt very, very welcome here, certainly by my aunt and uncle, and at work, and the people that I met. Both of them, I guess, were positive experiences. And that one experience in 1948 was the only negative experience, and it was just that one person. nothing else. I mean, I applied in other places for work, and nobody said, I won't hire you because you're Jewish. So I almost want to discount that as an aberration. When I came here, by the way, the trip on the Queen Elizabeth was just magnificent. The weather was beautiful. I was on deck the whole time. The only waves were from the breakwater. It was a wonderful holiday, I guess, that week. My aunt met me at the dock, and we arrived at her home at about 11:30 in the morning, and she said, I'm going to show you one of the miracles of the United States. She said, see this meat? It's raw, not cooked. I think it was a roast. And see these potatoes? See this vegetable? All raw. And in the half hour, we're going to be eating. And she put this on a pressure cooker. I don't know. Do you have those in England? And I had never seen a pressure cooker before. And so my aunt and I were talking. We're in the kitchen. And all of a sudden, the little thing that sits on top blew up and blew through the ceiling. And my aunt said, and I said to her, yes, this is one of the miracles of the United States. She said, this is